Members will call this meeting to order of the House Housing Committee. First order of business is approval of the minutes. I'll also note a quorum is present. Vice Chair Igbaje, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, and I move them.
So moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Members, we have two bills up today. The first is a bill that we had previously scheduled that we didn't quite get to, and so we'll welcome Representative Herr back to hear House File 317. Representative Herr, welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Howard and committee. I'm sad that it's not Klee Renters Protection Day here, but one bill is good. Thank you for making time to hear our last bill, which is House File 317. And that bill is a really simple bill. And I want to just emphasize that this bill actually passed out of two committees last year with unanimous support from both Democrats and Republicans. I see it as a non-controversial bill with zero fiscal note, but this bill is really simple. It just says that if you become ill or disabled and have a condition when your physician certifies that you can no longer live on your own in that space, that the landlord allows you to be able to break your lease. And so it's really simple. So that's the gist of the bill. And I do have a testifier here. I think I have two testifiers. There's one for and one against it. But if you wouldn't mind, I'll just turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you. Rachel Sterling's here with Homeline. Thanks for joining us.
Yep, thank you once again. Good to see everybody. So House File 317, as Representative Herr was saying, allows tenants who have an illness or disability to break their lease in order to move into a medical care facility. So, this committee did see this bill last year, so it may be familiar. But under the current Minnesota law, if a tenant becomes unable to use their rental unit due to a disability, illness, or medical condition, there is no explicit protection that lets them break their lease. So I've personally spoken with quite a few tenants who've experienced unexpected illnesses or disabilities that required them to move to a medical care facility for their own safety and for their own well-being, but they didn't have any easy recourse or any paths really to follow that were laid out for them and how to do that. Typically, I advise these tenants to try and negotiate an early termination with their landlord. And while some landlords are amenable to negotiating early terminations due to infirmity, I can definitely verify that that's not always the case. So tenants can incur exorbitant early termination fees because they need to move into a medical care facility, and their need to move drastically mitigates their negotiating power. I've also had tenants who had their credit destroyed because they moved because they need to, and their credit was destroyed, their names were submitted to collections, and landlords refused to terminate the lease, but also refused to re-rent. House File 317 offers a reasonable and balanced solution to this problem. So under House File 317, tenants could only break their lease if they have a medical professional verify in writing that the tenant has a condition which warrants breaking the lease because the tenant needs to move into a medical care facility. The statute would define medical care facility as a nursing home, hospice care, boarding care, supervised living facility or assisted living facility, an accessible unit, or a facility providing intensive residential rehabilitative mental health treatment. A tenant intending to follow the proposed law is required to give a written 2-month notice in advance, providing the landlord ample time to market the unit and re-rent it to a new tenant. The 2-month notice mirrors another Minnesota law, which allows the estate of a deceased tenant to terminate the lease within 60 days written notice. It's important to note that this bill is not trying to create an easy way for tenants to simply duck out of their lease contract responsibilities. Rather, it provides a legal, defined method for tenants to end their lease when a medical condition makes it impossible to continue living in their home. So this bill is necessary in order to create a procedure for those affected by severe infirmity to terminate their leases and get their needed medical care while still protecting landlords' interest in receiving proper notice and the ability to re-rent. So Homeline urges you to support House File 317. Thank you, Chair Howard and the committee.
Thank you. The next testifier is Kyle Burnt with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Burnt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Burnt. I'm the Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. come here today not to oppose the bill, but to raise some concerns that we have within the way that it's drafted. We have three primary concerns. The first is that we are concerned about the timeline in the proposal and how that might differ from federal requirements for an accommodation. Second is we believe infirmity as defined in this proposal should have some sort of duration that they are expected to be infirm. We would suggest 90 days of expectation of stay in a facility. Third, we are concerned about a resident who provides the 2-month notice, and as the previous testifier mentioned, obviously housing providers are going to want to re-rent that unit. Come to the end of the notice period, if it's a pending application they use for the application to leave or for the to leave, after the 2-month notice, you could end up with a situation where you have a tenant who doesn't have an opportunity to leave because they haven't been accepted, and then you have another person who's coming in who might no longer have anywhere else to go. So in those situations, you could certainly destabilize the housing of two different households. And with that, we'll continue to work with the author and members of the committee on the bill going forward and appreciate the opportunity to set it in.
Thank you. Those are our testifiers. Is there anyone else here that would like to offer testimony to the bill? If not, we can move to member questions. Are there questions that members have for Representative Herr? Going once. Representative Herr, if there are no questions, any final comments on your bill?
No, just that.
I will go to Representative Johnson. Looks like he has a question.
Chair Howard, Representative Herr, I understand the concept of this, and I think it's a good idea. But as was mentioned, there's some things that we should look at. It's brought up the timeline, the duration the person is going to be in, whether it's a nursing home or some type of treatment or whatever. And also, another issue that I'm concerned about is if there's nobody there to get that person's property out, if they've been placed in a nursing home, who is going to be responsible to protect the property that's in that a unit, and how long are they going to have to maintain it before it can be disposed of?
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Howard, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for the question. And I know that we've actually thoroughly talked through these particular items in previous years. The fact that we're already giving 2 months' notice and what multi-housing is asking for is really an additional 30 days on top of that. And we find that if somebody is going to be giving you 2 months' notice already, it's probably because they're not coming back anytime soon. And so the concerns that I think that they're bringing up, though I appreciate them, I feel like the conditions of which we put in the strict as the facilities that they have to actually move into and the conditions in which how they become, like the notices that are given, is actually quite stringent. And so I feel like what we've given is actually quite reasonable. And I'll also let my testifier add anything else onto that. But we have thoroughly vetted why the provisions of how we've written it actually is really important, especially for somebody who is experiencing these specific infirmity issues.
Ms. Sterling.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Johnson, just to the abandoned property question, there is already a statute in place that deals with that specific concern. So I can go into detail if you'd like, but that this particular statute would follow those same obligations that are under current law.
Representative Johnson, follow up. Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Herr, I appreciate the intent of this bill, and thank you for bringing that to us today. Question I have is what would happen, I'll just say a scenario, if the tenant actually gives a notice to vacate, 2 months comes and they do not vacate the property, are there some mechanisms for the property provider to have assurance that these people are going to actually be vacating the property after that 2 months so they don't have to start the eviction process and go through that whole process as well?
Representative Herr, or maybe Ms. Sterling.
Thank you, Chair Howard. You said to avoid the eviction process, right?
For clarification, something happens where they find that where they were going, that situation where 2 months and they're not able to get into their new facility where they're proposed to go, because now the landlord is trying to make new arrangements, I guess.
Thank you.
Ms. Sterling.
The clarification. Yep. Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative, I mean, notice, I would never counsel anyone to give a notice of their intent to vacate if they don't for sure know where they're going to land, basically. So, but that is really between them and their medical provider as to what that timeline looks like. But there are provisions in place for if a tenant just decides they don't want to leave but have given a proper notice, the same that are in existence now. So,
Representative Nash.
I tried to not have a question on every bill, but it didn't work out this time. Representative Herr, I think I heard from Mr. Burnt scenario. They give 2 months, they go into a facility, and let's say they have an excellent recovery, and they may want to go back. During that two-month interregnum, they've gone to the purpose of getting it rented out or getting it set up and paperwork has been. How do you sort all that out? Because I didn't hear the answer for that, and I wanted to actually know. Are you accounting for that? So please help me out there, because I'm trying to figure that part out. And if Mr. Burnt would maybe come down and verify that that's his concern indeed.
Mr. Burnt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash. Apologies if I was unclear. My testimony was intended to highlight when somebody has a pending application, which does not confirm that they will be going into housing 2 months later, and that if that application is still pending at the end of the notice period, and another individual is expecting to move into that facility, then you have an issue there where you have two households for one facility, and at some point, something has to happen to address the two households looking for housing in this 1 year.
Representative Nash.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And that goes to the question is, how do you, if you've got somebody who is committed to leaving and somebody else who has been committed to coming in, how do you resolve that? And I don't know how often that would happen, but for those of you that have enjoyed the questions that I've asked over time, you know that I ask a lot of what ifs, because what ifs become realities if we don't think about them.
Representative Herr.
I mean, I would say that right now, that can happen to people who aren't leaving for infirmity reasons too, right? So like you would just follow what you would normally follow as a landlord. I think that's why this bill is actually really supported. It was supported by both sides of the aisle because it actually is a win-win for both the tenant and the landlord. You don't actually have to change anything that you're doing right now, because that happens in scenarios in which somebody doesn't go into infirmity either. You just follow the same laws.
Any other questions from members? If not, I will make my motion, because I forgot to do that, that House File 317 be re-referred to the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion carries, and the bill is on its way to Judiciary. Thank you, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Representative Herr.
Up next, we have House File 685 from Vice Chair Igbaje. And Vice Chair Igbaje, would you like to move that House File 685 be re-referred to the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Wonderful. The bill is before the committee. Representative Igbaje, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Members, the bill before you today is a start at addressing a persistent trend in Minnesota and around the country when it comes to the home ownership market, and that is corporate ownership of single-family homes. The bill would prohibit corporate entities, including real estate developers and residential building contractors, from buying single-family homes for the sole purpose of turning them into rentals. Corporations can be exempt from this prohibition if the exemption would not preclude the goal of preservation and owner-occupied home ownership. Currently, enforcement is written in this bill through the Attorney General's Office, and Minnesota Housing would manage the exemption list. As we've discussed multiple times in this committee, home ownership in Minnesota is something that continues to be out of reach for many Minnesotans of color and many working class Minnesotans. The reasons are varied, from the lack of supply to high cost of housing to discriminatory practices in the market, and of course, corporate ownership of single family homes. This bill proposes one solution to the problem of corporate home ownership by creating a more level home buying market that gives more space for everyday Minnesotans who desire to own a home to have a shot in the marketplace. According to reports from the Federal Reserve, Pew Charitable Trust, and reporting done by the Star Tribune and others, corporate entities are purchasing more homes in the marketplace to the detriment of many first-time homebuyers. Corporate ownership doubled their share of the market from 2006 until now, and the trend shows that these purchases are concentrated in black and brown or low-income neighborhoods. Recent studies in the metro area show that there are higher concentrations of corporate-owned housing in communities like Northeast Minneapolis and the suburbs of Pridley and Hopkins. In those areas, corporate home ownership of single-family homes is 30%, 27%, and 24%, respectively. And in many of those areas, the share of corporate owners who are large owners, that is those who own 50 or more properties, is growing. This means in those communities, families and working people are continually shut out of the marketplace from corporate owners who can offer cash and forego inspection fees or other contingencies that regular Minnesotans cannot. This leaves them with the only option to rent from these corporate landlords if they want to stay in their neighborhoods. And part of the reason why a bill like this is necessary is it also starts to get at the idea and the issue of corporate owners who can sometimes be absentee landlords. They have limited property management oversight of their units, and they don't address repairs in a timely fashion. And we've seen some stories show that sometimes the only time you hear from some of these corporate landlords is when the rent is due. And many of the most egregious issues have come out of the story with Havenbrook Homes that was going around last year. So by limiting the amount of single-family homes that corporate entities can own, hopefully we can have more homeowners that are present in their communities. And that is the general purpose of this bill. The measure is meant to ensure that Minnesotans, wherever they are, know that they will compete in an even playing field to get an opportunity at home ownership. Home ownership builds wealth and opportunity for themselves and future generations. So let's work at that opportunity by removing a variety of barriers, including this one, to the American dream. And with that, I welcome the conversation that we'll have this afternoon, starting with our testifiers.
Thank you, Vice Chair. First, we have Daniel Lightfoot with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Or no, that's incorrect. As I said it, I'm like, that's not correct, with the League of Minnesota Cities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as much affinity as I have for my local government brothers and sisters in our counties, my name is Daniel Lightfoot and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, which represents 837 member cities across the state of Minnesota. So I don't think I'm going to be able to correct the minutes, so I'll just rely on one of you all to do that next time around. But I appreciate the opportunity to testify. The League doesn't have a specific policy position on House File 685 and this particular approach, assessing trends in corporate investor ownership of single-family housing stock in Minnesota cities and mitigating any negative impacts that this trend is having on home ownership opportunities, as was mentioned by Representative Igbaje, is an important issue that we as an organization in cities across the metro specifically are monitoring carefully. We appreciate Representative Igbaje's attention to this issue and for the conversations around the trend of investor and corporate purchases of single-family homes, which in a number of neighborhoods, as referenced in the Minneapolis Federal Reserve report, has reduced the number of home ownership opportunities for residents and in many cases are concentrated to lower-income neighborhoods and neighborhoods with higher populations of BIPOC residents, which in some cases is leading to the exacerbation of the racial gap in home ownership. This was a topic of great interest during the League of Minnesota Cities Housing Task Force meetings over the interim and resulted in our board adopting a task force recommended policy to support tools and mitigate negative impacts on city housing stock and prospective home buyers due to investor and corporate ownership of housing. We've heard scenarios in cities lately where single-family subdivisions have been put in where the city is under the impression that it will be a single-family owner-occupied units, owner-occupied housing. Then down the road, as the subdivision is completed, that subdivision is then sold to an investor party, which flips those homes into single-family rentals. We've also heard challenges with nuisance code enforcement and rental licensing and poor conditions of rental properties owned by out-of-state owners. In closing, and to be clear, it's important for any city to have a diverse array of housing stock That certainly includes rental and certainly includes single-family rentals. The concern that we have and that the trend that we're monitoring is to the extent investor purchases are in some neighborhoods removing home ownership opportunities for residents in a tight housing market, and it's important for the legislature to monitor this trend and consider tools at the state and the local level to reduce the potential negative impacts that could arise should this trend continue. So thanks again to Representative Igbaje and Mr. Chair and members, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot, with the League of Minnesota Cities. Next up, we have Teme Ugunrinde with the Urban Homeworks. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Teme Ugunrinde, and I'm the Equity and Engagement Director at Urban Homeworks. Chair Howard, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding House File 685. Thank you, Representative Igbaje, for moving this bill forward and the opportunity to testify on behalf of Urban Homeworks, our residents, and larger community. Urban Homeworks provides affordable housing and homeownership opportunities to our residents in the Minneapolis and St. Paul region. Because of the work we do, we know the importance of this bill passing, and that is why we are in full support of House File 685. The purchase of single-family homes by corporate entities has kept Minnesota families from owning a home for too long. Even at the onset of the pandemic, with extremely low interest rates, families were priced out of an extremely competitive market. Even with the ability to pay their mortgage, potential home buyers didn't stand a chance to the onslaught of out-of-state corporate entities buying homes with cash offers and more. This not only drives up the housing prices in the market, making home ownership deeply unaffordable, but it indirectly impacts rent, making that unaffordable as well. The numbers don't lie, and I'll reiterate some of the statistics that Rep. Igbaje shared. But the recent report by the Minnesota Federal Reserve shows the rising tide of investor ownership of single-family homes. In North Minneapolis specifically, investor ownership grew by over 20% by 2021. This trend has not been relegated, though, to just the Minneapolis and St. Paul region. The Reserve reported similar growth patterns in suburbs like Fridley, where investor ownership was over 27%. This is occurring throughout Minnesota, and I urge each representative to take seriously the impact that it's having on your constituents. But I want to stress how deeply inequitable these practices are. There's a negative, disparate impact that investor ownership is having on the communities of North Minneapolis. Investor ownership is occurring at over 20% in this area compared to an average of 4% in the larger metro area. Not only does this prevent many BIPOC families from building wealth from home ownership, but this extracts income from hardworking Minnesota families and puts it into the pockets of corporations who don't reside in these communities or even the state. House File 685 would give Minnesota families and individuals the fighting chance they deserve to achieve their dream of home ownership. But this bill does more than just that. It also helps strengthen communities. Several studies show that positive impact owning a home has on strengthening communities. The opportunity to build and invest cannot happen if you're constantly being displaced due to landlords' price gouging. These corporations are often buying up single-family homes, and in an effort to maximize profits, they raise rent without properly maintaining the property. This leads to often disinvested, dilapidated homes in neighborhoods. These corporate landlords often don't live in the community, thus not caring about building it up and ensuring that these neighborhoods thrive. And yet, as cities start putting money into redevelopment, Minnesota families aren't benefiting. This gentrification often leads to displacement because it allows landlords to increase rent as the neighborhoods become more attractive to outsiders. This doesn't lift up community, but rather disrupts neighborhoods of old. I truly believe in the impact that House File 685 can have on the communities we serve. It will ensure communities in North Minneapolis and throughout the state of Minnesota will have the opportunity to buy a home in the community they love while giving them the opportunity to rebuild so that every individual and family, both now and generations to come, have the opportunity to see the fruit of their labor and sacrifice. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Paul Egger with Minnesota Realtors.
Good
Member of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Egger, and I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. And we're a business trade association with over 22,000 members working with buyers and sellers of all types of property every day. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today to share some of our thoughts and a few concerns with Representative Egbaje's House File 685. I'd also like to thank Representative Egbaje for the conversation we had last week. It was very helpful and look forward to continuing the dialogue with you as the session progresses. Mr. Chair, members, Minnesota Realtors supports getting more Minnesotans into home ownership. Realtors are out representing their buyer clients every day as they try to find a home. For buyers over the past couple of years, finding a home has been challenging and at times frustrating because of the severe lack of housing inventory, which I'll get back to shortly. We also support the open real estate market and have concerns with any bill, including House File 685, which would restrict access for some, creating the potential for unintended consequences for others. We would urge caution as you consider House File 685 because market conditions can change over time. While the current market is characterized by a dramatic lack of housing inventory, just 11 years ago we were trying to emerge from the housing crash and a foreclosure crisis. In fact, in February 2012, the Federal Housing Finance Agency announced a pilot program for investors interested in buying Fannie Mae foreclosed properties for use as rentals. FHFA's acting director, Edward DeMarco, was quoted in a press release saying, quote, "This is another important milestone in our initiative designed to reduce taxpayer losses, stabilize neighborhoods and home values, shift to more private management of properties, and reduce the supply of REO properties in the marketplace." A Reuters article from July 3, 2012 stated that the FHFA, quote, "wants to use the program to shrink the excess supply of repossessed homes weighing on the market." I mean, think about that for a second. 11 years ago, the problem was excess supply of repossessed homes weighing on the market. From 2009 to 2012 in Minnesota, around one-third of all sales each year were lender-mediated. That's foreclosures or short sales. In 2022, that number was less than 1%. Although the number of lender-mediated sales ticked up slightly from 2021. This illustrates how market conditions can and do change over time, and what may seem like a reasonable market intervention today could present a barrier to innovation or the ability to respond to changing market conditions tomorrow. We would also urge caution in assuming that any investor-purchased property would simply have been purchased by an owner-occupant. Some properties purchased by investors are in rough shape, certainly not turnkey, and they fix them up, turning them into nice places to live. On this point, a Minneapolis Federal Reserve article from just last week titled Investor-Owned Homes Ebb and Flow in the Minneapolis-St. Paul Region notes, quote, "In communities that saw high shares of foreclosures, converting foreclosed homes into rental homes minimized the occurrence of vacant boarded-up homes and created opportunities for displaced homeowners to stay in their neighborhoods." Further, the National Association of Realtors reported in May 2022 that, quote, 42% of realtors reported institutional investors typically purchased properties that needed repair. It's also to keep in mind that a property purchased today and converted into a rental may be sold to an owner-occupant later. That January 17th Minneapolis Federal Reserve article also states, quote, "Then the redistribution of investor-owned single-family rental homes across the region over the last 5 years, the share of investor ownership is falling in many of the census tracts that had relatively higher rates of investor ownership in 2017. As these tracts have not seen large increases in the number of investor-owned single-family homes overall, these data suggest that homes in these neighborhoods are returning to being owner-occupied. Having a real estate market that does not prohibit or restrict investors can be beneficial to sellers, particularly when that demand drops, and buyer demand drops. Situations may arise for individuals and families, whether it be divorce, loss of job, transfer to another part of the state or country, where a timely sale and immediate closing is critical, and sometimes investors are able to make that purchase when others aren't interested when there aren't interested buyers. And back to just the current market for 1 second, Mr. Chair. While the market has slowed, there is still a severe lack of housing inventory, with only 9,200 homes for sale in December. That's statewide. For the years 2017 through 2020, the average number of homes for sale at the end of the year was about 14,500. And even that number represents a lack of adequate supply to meet the growing demand for housing. The best way to minimize the role of investors in the market is to increase the supply of housing. We are definitely in a sustained period of low housing supply, and focusing on investors, unfortunately, will not solve that challenging problem. Implementing policies that remove barriers to developing more housing of all types and price points, increasing resources for down payment assistance, which we're really happy to be working with Representative Bajaj on this session, and ensuring that homeowner property taxes are reasonable and relief programs are updated on a regular basis would be more impactful than enacting market restrictions and prohibitions on investors. And finally, I just want to reference a few items in the bill on which we would appreciate some additional conversation as it moves forward. And there are several definitions in the bill, Mr. Chair. Family LLC and family trust. We're just having a difficult time as we read the language, understanding if there's additional action that somebody with an LLC currently that would fall under those definitions would have to do in order to qualify as a family LLC, for example. The definition of real estate developer in the bill seems really broad. We'd appreciate some additional conversation around what exact activities would fall under that definition of real estate developer. And I think we would also like to understand if there's a threshold number for investor ownership that is of particular concern. I did look at some of the data that's available on the Minneapolis Fed's property data tool on investor ownership of single-family homes in the seven-county metro area, and it showed investors with 50 or more properties accounting for less than 2% of single-family homes in the Twin Cities. If you change the parameter to 10 or more properties, it's 2%. So we're just trying to get an understanding maybe if there's a threshold that there's of particular concern. I think finally it's just important to keep in mind that this bill would not just apply to the metro area or to a specific neighborhood or region. It would be statewide in application. And so just to keep that in mind as you're considering what impact this bill would have. And with that, Mr. Chair, again, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and Representative Bajaj, thank you for the conversation. Look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Up next we have Nick Erickson with Housing First. Mr. Erickson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Nick Erickson. I am the Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota. We're a statewide trade association focused on home ownership. Our mission is to increase home ownership opportunities for all. And while we are a home ownership centric entity, we do have significant concerns as this bill has the potential to actually worsen our state's housing crisis. I do want to thank the author for meeting with our team this weekend to discuss some of our concerns. Wanted to bring those before this entire committee today. Housing affordability and access are determined by the health of our housing ecosystem, which unfortunately right now in Minnesota is in peril. By some estimates, our housing deficit today is as high as 95,000 units. This deficit is growing. We have to be adding more housing supply to our state in order to reduce that deficit. Here in the Twin Cities, we have the widest homeownership equity gap in the nation, and our new home construction costs in Minnesota are 30% higher than in Wisconsin and 22% higher even in Illinois. One of the biggest concerns that we have with this bill is it does effectively ban single-family build for rent. Now, what does the home ownership group care about that? Well, it's that research shows that all housing, especially in a critically undersupplied market like ours, is good. The committee must know that this bill, as written, would stop needed new housing from being added to our housing market. Housing First Minnesota shares the goals of reducing housing costs and increasing housing access. It is our passion and is our mission. You'll not find a more passionate group of home ownership advocates than our team. We view single-family rentals as a symptom of a broken housing market. It is not the cause. Fixing housing in Minnesota requires us to turn our attention to the causes and not the symptoms. Whether it's single-family build for rent or large companies, small companies converting for ownership to for rental, the reason this is happening is because we have a critical lack of supply here in our market. We see this in regulatory filings. We see this in media articles. Time and time again, they tell us we're here because there's not enough homes. And when it comes to single-family rentals, the solution is simple. It's to build more housing. legalizing new starter home construction is the number one way to disincentivize the rental activity we see both in conversions and single family build for rent. Legalizing new starter homes is best accomplished with regulatory roadblocks and modernization. We're seeing this in California, Washington, Massachusetts, Oregon, New York, Virginia, Montana, are all states that have or are looking to this session modernizing their housing to address their housing supply problems. Big, bold, that is what's needed. When you solve the supply side, you're going to solve all these symptoms of the broken housing market. So thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, please let me know.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to questions. And I have the first question, Representative Bajaj. This last the last discussion about the supply shortage, do you believe that's, is this a both-and situation? Do we need to be addressing that as well as this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. I agree with that. We do have issues on the supply side, as we've heard here in this committee, but we also have issues in a lot of the ways that housing is sold and rented and kind of divvied out amongst our community. So I think we need to be looking at all approaches. I definitely welcome solutions that work on the supply side, but we're also looking for solutions that address the current needs that people have now. So while single family rentals may be symptomatic and there may be deeper causes, at least trying to address what is bringing up this large amount of single family rentals across our state is something that I think we need to start looking at in a variety of ways.
Obviously a leading question there by the chair, but I just want to encourage us, I think that so often in on this issue in housing, we need this all hands on deck approach. And so there are so many things we need to be doing to bring solutions to bear. And so wanted to raise that up. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a series of questions and I'll try to be expedient about it. Members, I did put in your packet last night an article from The Atlantic, and the author is Jerusalem Demsis. It's a very illustrative read regarding some of the assertions that have been made relative to corporate-owned housing driving up the cost of rentals and making it unaffordable. I think that it's worth a read, and I think that it's notable that The Atlantic is the source of the article. I don't know if Mr. Chair had an opportunity to read the article. It is not something that you would immediately attribute to a publication like The Atlantic. It has a decidedly different perspective and a more laissez-faire capitalistic perspective. So, members, I would encourage you to read that. But to the author, on line 2.3, you're limiting a family limited liability to having no more than five members, correct?
Representative Bajaj.
Mr. Chair, if you just give me a second. 2.3, you said?
Yes, 2.3.
Okay. Yes, it's currently listed as no more than five members.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Agbaje, this is actually a conversation that my wife and I have had around our kitchen table. We have six kids, and if we have a limited family corporation, my wife, myself, and all of our kids, then you've taken away the opportunity for us to invest in real estate as a potential business that could put some or many of our children on a foot towards a business that they may run, providing perhaps rental properties. And the focus of our conversation, Mr. Chair, and to the author, has been around where can we buy houses where our kids want to go to college and provide college rentals for people who might want to do this. If your bill were to become law, one, my family is SOL, and I would take issue with that because we are obviously greater than the number that you have allowed for. Second variation on the same theme, some friends of mine and I actually have also talked about doing this very thing in creating a lakeshore, a destination for our family. So we each own a portion of everything. We go in aggregate and we buy multiple houses. We're sort of creating our own little resort that may then go to VRBO or rental or whatever. But there's more than five of us, and now we are precluded from exercising our desire to pursue property rights in a capitalistic society where if we have the cash, we get to buy some things. So if you would, Representative Agbaje, maybe address those two issues, and then we'll jump into some others.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash. I think to the first question about your family business, many people, when they enter a family business, not every member of the family is in that business. I'm not sure if all six of you want to be in that business. If you do, that's definitely something we can look at to maybe kind of arrange the wording so that way we're looking at a whole family that is actually a family unit. So that's something that we can look at for future stops. I got a little bit lost in the type of company you're trying to build with the VRBOs and the resort. So if you could kind of break that down a little bit for me, that would be helpful.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I'll lay it out. And then five friends and their spouses and I have talked about buying multiple houses around a lake or in a town near a lake. And if this bill were to become law, let's say there's 10 of us, and we want to buy a bunch of different houses, we all throw money in together. If this bill were to become law, I can't do that anymore. I can't. And as a lifelong property rights person, I take some issue with that. And I also know that it's not just me who might be thinking along these lines. I know many people who own downtown homes in a corporation that have more than five people that are not family, that they make their living off of this. This is a very restrictive and frightening bill as it relates to the free exercise of my ability to buy stuff, if I so choose, in a partnership that I may wish to enter in. And I'm not a lawyer, we've got a couple on the committee, but I find that particularly troubling that you would write your bill that tightly, that you would preclude me from being able to go into a partnership with people to buy things that are on the open market. Because when somebody puts up a for sale sign, it is now entering into the open market.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash. Yeah, you are correct. As this is written, we are trying to limit the amount of corporate ownership of single-family homes, especially if they are just going to be turned over for rental. There is a significant trend also as well as corporations coming in and buying single-family homes and also turning them into short-term rentals like Airbnb, VRBOs, other groups. And so what we're trying to do is making sure that where those properties are, particularly if they're in areas that are people, regular working class, everyday Minnesotans are having a hard time buying property, entering home ownership, having their property rights, be trampled on. That's something that we're trying to mitigate. Now, we do have exemption, and it is possible that perhaps your localized LLC with your friends could fall under one of those exemptions, or we could also entertain language for other types of exemptions. So the current purpose of the bill, I'll just go back to that, is really making sure that we are limiting the practices of what we're seeing in corporate entities, especially larger ones, that are coming in, buying large swaths of neighborhoods, large swaths of properties, and effectively shutting out regular Minnesotans from the market.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll use another example then. In a time that Mr. Egger actually mentioned, I was mayor in the city of Waconia during the housing downturn, and there were two developments that were undeveloped land, which your bill also says that you can't build on these things, and I have some concerns about. But the city ultimately, and it sucked, but we became the landowner and we had to sell parcels off. And what we wound up doing is we would sell to developers who wanted to come in and buy a prescribed number of pieces of land, and many of those were partnerships that were formed from disparate groups of people who created an LLC that then invested their own capital to buy that land. And now this bill, and I wish to correct you, you say you're not trying to change or limit, you're seeking to eliminate the ability to do this. The language is quite clear. You're not trying to jiggle the toilet handle. You're trying to make it so that I can't buy land or these other people can't buy houses or whatever. There are some profound capitalistic philosophical differences that I can't wrap my head around. And there aren't really good answers for it. And I would point out that, once again, from The Atlantic, there's a great quote, and I'll be very quick, but it says in the article, "I don't want to be hyperbolic, but the idea that these firms are ultimately responsible for our housing affordability crisis is absolutely ridiculous. And no one who knows anything about housing markets believes it." The premise of the article is that the amount of impact being foisted on these markets by these corporate entities and corporations could be six or seven of us as an LLC, as you've agreed. The impact is not quite as profound as we would argue. But, Mr. Chair, I think that there are some real problems with this. I've given examples of multiple exclusions, and the author has agreed that I'm right on these things. I'm really frightened by what this could do to anybody's constituents. So my side, your side, if you have a group of people who want to get together and say, you know what, let's invest in our neighborhood, let's buy up some of these houses, let's fix them up, let's spruce them up, and then find people who can rent to eventually own, this bill eliminates that opportunity. It does. We just heard that it does. So for those who are in an area where you have people who want to own a home and you want to get together with some of your friends to create a corporate entity to buy up some of these houses to eventually hand over to people who will buy them from you, you can't do that. That is absolutely frightening. And I will have maybe some questions later, but Mr. Chair and the author, you and I have worked on a number of issues and we have a great dialogue. This one scares the bejeebers out of me and I cannot get behind this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash, I would note from that same Atlantic article, which I did read, the quote that there are real problems with corporate landlords. For instance, large corporate investors are significantly more likely to file eviction notices. And we've seen that here in Minnesota with Havenbrook, where the Attorney General has sued an entity that owns hundreds of homes and has been a real bad partner. And so I just wanted to raise that up since you referenced that article.
And Mr. Chair, since you mentioned my name, I'll invoke that unspoken rule we have in committee. I would argue that while that could be true, it's not as pernicious as the articles that are also offered or as the author supposes are actually becoming reality. So I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but there is no limit that's articulated in the bill that says, oh, we can own 10 homes, but not 12. It just says you can't do it. I find that deeply troubling and deeply problematic.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bajaj.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. No, I mean, I think you are definitely bringing up a lot of good points that need to be addressed in the bill. One of the things I will say, though, is that for people who are in situations where they could buy a home, they want to buy a home, they are shut out of the market, and so they're left in a single-family home, and the corporate landlords are, unfortunately, absentee landlords, that's a very serious situation. And we want to address those serious situations. And so this is part of getting there. This, you know, we have a number of committee stops. I'm welcoming number of language changes, number of discussions around threshold, discussions around what these definitions look like. I've been in those conversations already, and so we're continuing to have them. And, you know, I'm hopeful that by the time this is done, this will be in a shape that more people can support.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Howard, and to Representative Igbaji for bringing this bill forward. You know, I was thinking about also not only the rents being driven up, but in my community in greater Minnesota, I've also seen sometimes the predatory nature that can happen with these corporate investors who offer cash, but of course not as much as homeowners could get had they gone through traditional routes. And talking with the housing leaders in my community, they mentioned that while this trend is not hit in full force in our area yet, we are starting to see some impacts with corporate investors purchasing up mobile manufactured homes, and that is a big problem. And just wondering if that's something that would be covered under this current bill, and if that's something that you've heard from other folks that you've worked with across the state. Thank you.
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. That's also a good question. I think that's something that we'll have to keep talking about in the conversation to see best where it fits. But, you know, ideally, the purpose of this is really to protect those homeowners that are not really having this opportunity. So like you said, it's coming across the state. It's already showing up. And we want to be sure that, you know, as much as, you know, corporations can play in the marketplace in certain ways, we also want to be sure that our our regular everyday Minnesotans, our working class Minnesotans, our families, our people who want to get into the American dream of home ownership can also have an opportunity to.
Representative Kozlowski.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you and appreciate that as we look also what we can do proactively to prevent some of the harm that we've seen in other areas to spreading further. So thank you so much.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. More just a couple questions operationally. So for this bill, if it passes, I mean, is it going to be retroactive? How do you look at the current people that are owning these properties for rental?
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. Most language and legislation is usually forward-looking, so it would be for sales moving forward.
Representative Myers.
Thank you. So, you know, when they go to sell, they would have to sell to individual homeowners, correct?
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that would be correct.
Representative Myers.
Okay. And then I do see in here as far as, you know, what I'll call an exception about the review process. And I think people that, you know, are in the industry and we've seen how quickly real estate can be, you know, snatched up. It can be very time sensitive. I mean, do we have any idea what this review process looks like or how long it would take?
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. Just to clarify, you're talking about the exemption review process.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Myers, yes. I mean, I think that might be a good idea to put some timelines on the review process. You know, we don't want to necessarily hamstring the group that's going to be doing that, but at the same time, it does make sense for people to know in a timely fashion whether they meet the exemption or not.
Representative Myers.
Thank you. And I appreciate you, you know, looking at that. The other piece, if I'm reading this correctly, this doesn't stop. I'll just use Representative Nash because he's talking about all this property he's going to buy. It doesn't stop them from personally going and buying 10 houses and then renting it out, does it?
Representative Igbaje.
Mr. Chair and Representative Myers. So, no. I mean, if you are, like, an individual person and you want to buy property and then you want to rent it out, you could do that. I don't know the mechanics of all that. Unfortunately, not purchased a home yet. I'm in one of those people who are still looking to do so. But the idea is really on, you know, and this is part of the language that we'll probably end up tightening up, but really on those larger organizations, those larger investor groups, those groups that are able to purchase multiple homes at one shot, and not really just kind of the one-on-one person.
Representative Myers.
Yep, thank you for that. You know, I think it is important. You know, I know in my area we, you know, have some neighbors that own properties within the community that they rent out, and they're the property managers there. And what I don't want to do is, you know, take a potential tool away from, you know, the housing crisis that we do have to, you know, and the chair and I talked about earlier, people that are willing to build, fix up properties, you know, put shovels in the ground. And I think there may be a potential that this limits one of the tools. The other piece in there, it talks about actually building homes. So if I owned a piece of property and switched it over to an LLC and I built that, you know, built a house and turned it into a rental, I wouldn't be able to do that either, correct?
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. So that's language again. Right now, I think the way it's currently written, it's a little bit restrictive in that space. But I have been talking with different developers, looking at seeing ways that we can try to make sure that we're addressing their needs as well as the needs of others.
Representative Myers.
Yep, and I appreciate that. Again, that, you know, that build piece is what really stuck out to me because, again, we want people to invest and produce those you know, housing options for people that need it. So we can actually, again, you know, shovels in the ground and you know, build units for people to live in. So thank you.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Vice Chair Igbaje, for this bill. For some of us that represent urban core districts, this is a common problem that we see. I remember, I think it was 2021 or 2020, when Zillow decided to buy, you know, blocks and blocks of North Minneapolis homes. And, you know, didn't fix anything but jacked up the price twice and just was renting it. And because of the home, you know, affordability crisis that we're in, people were forced to rent the same space that they were in before twice the price. So this is a real problem in some of the communities. I understand that some folks represent, you know, communities where, you know, this isn't a real problem, but this is a real problem in the urban core. And when somebody owns a property and it's owned by an individual and you are renting, it's different than when it's owned by corporate. And you call a 1-800 number and leave a message and you might or may not get a phone call back. It's a different feeling, and there is a lot of tendency for abuse when it's corporate, you know, firm that owns that and doesn't even live in the state. I just, while, you know, we were just talking about this, I just Googled, you know, corporate ownership in homes in Minnesota, and at least 10 articles pop up. So this is a problem in the urban core, and I want to thank you for this bill, and I'm happy that we're having this conversation. I hope we continue having this conversation because this is not a problem that's going away. I see it as a problem that will continue to increase. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, over the years, I've learned that things never stay static. Everything is always changing, right? As I remember, right, 30 years ago or so, every person was driving to work by car. And they wanted to. They enjoyed that. That's not the trend today. Today, there's a growing trend of those who want to go to public transit. And we talk about home ownership as if the desire is for everybody to actually purchase and own the home. And I've talked to so many people, younger generations and others, and even older, that have rented all their life, and that's what they want to do. They have just as much pride and interest in being a renter as they are in home ownership as well. And I see that changing because there's a large cash investment, there's maintenance that has to be done, a lot of that stuff that people don't want to do anymore. And so rental is fine. And so my question, I guess, is a couple directed kind of to that. And one is, isn't there also a benefit in maintaining the unit as a residence available unit rather than just letting it go off the market or something? And isn't there also a benefit in the values of the property staying up because it was actually purchased at a better price? I mean, because I do think everybody who owns a house would like to get the best price for that house as well. And if that's the corporate, that's where the direction they're going to go. So are we concerned about that at all, and whether or not that's an issue that is also valuable or not?
Representative Abadje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, there will still be multiple markets for different types of housing. What we're trying to get at, again, if you are an individual, if you are, you know, we may have thresholds on this later, so if you're a smaller group, you could still put up housing for rent. But what we're really trying to get at is this idea of, again, having larger groups or people who are able to buy multiple homes at one time, turn them into rental properties, precluding the availability of people in those communities to be homeowners because they want to be homeowners. You know, we have a number of stories. There's one here from the Star Tribune where in the community of Lauderdale, you know, one owner there who was able to own dozens of single family homes. But, you know, people were being shut out of the market because they were being outbid by corporate entities. And so that's what we're trying to get at. I think to your question, we want to be able to kind of use this as another tool to help more people get into home ownership, because then they'll stay in their communities longer. They'll keep, with a stake in the community, a stake in property, they're more likely to upkeep that property. Unlike single family rentals, where sometimes you're kind of moving tenants in and out. I've talked to constituents in my district who have, you know, commented to me that they appreciate when people buy homes in their neighborhoods rather than rent them. Because sometimes with the people who are the owners, they don't really know who they're renting to, and they don't really sometimes it's hard to get them involved in the fabric of the community rather than a homeowner. But it's not to disparage renters. I'm a renter myself, but you know, there are, and there'll still be a market for that, but we want to make sure that we're keeping that space open in the homeownership market too.
Representative Petersburg?
Yep, thank you, and I agree with that. You know, I think there's none of us around this table that don't want to deal with the bad apples. I mean, those that are abusing their authority and raising prices and so forth. And unfortunately, that can happen as an individual landlord as well, or housing provider, whichever you want to call them. And it's not just the corporate issue that can create that problem. But I can tell you that those that are developing rental units, I actually live in one when I'm up here at the Capitol. The company that owns where I live has an advertisement right on the elevator that they are the largest rental provider in the state of Minnesota with over 45 various complexes. My building alone is 30 stories tall. And that certainly is a corporation, right? I mean, and so there are people and corporations that do a good job. The concern is let's deal with the real issue if there's an issue there rather than using the entire sledgehammer to eliminate the whole thing. And that's the only concern that I have is I don't know if this is necessarily the best direction to actually solve the problem, which I think is a valid problem. I'm not saying that. I think it's an issue that we need to deal with. But we have, on the one hand, people want to sell their home and want to get the best price they can. You want communities to have that building, that place sold. We also have a community that doesn't want bad renters to come in there as well. And all of those are difficult tasks to kind of juggle. I appreciate what you've done and tried, but I do think there's some concerns here. So thank you.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to share that, you know, I, along with many members of my generation, have had personal experience dealing with this. I was fortunate to not too long ago be able to buy my first home and try to do everything right. I mean, I worked for years to save up a good down payment. I worked with a reputable financing company, and it was really frustrating to constantly be making offers and to have those offers beat out by people who were coming in with all cash offers. And what made it especially challenging was because of the pricing in our housing market right now, I realized quickly I wasn't going to be able to own just a single family home. I was going to have to be looking at a townhome. And those are even more attractive to folks who are looking to buy them up and rent them out. And eventually I was able to secure one in part because I, you know, spent more than I wanted to and waived some contingencies that I didn't want to. And that's what it took to finally actually buy a house. And I think as a state, we have to wrestle with what do we want our policy to be around housing? You look at what housing has done and home ownership has done over the years to build generational wealth. And so we have a choice here as a state. Do we want to continue to maintain that and make sure that families are able to purchase homes and do so reasonably with reasonable down payments and not have to have all cash offers and waive all kinds of contingencies? Or are we content to create a situation where we're all just renting from corporate landlords? And I tend to think that Minnesota will be better off in the long run if the majority of folks who want to are able to purchase a family home of their own.
I've got Representative Cha, and then I saw Representative Petersburg wants to get back on the list as well, but I'll go to Representative Cha next.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I spent over 15 years in the mortgage and real estate market in my career. I understand Representative Nash wanting to, buy properties for family and leisure. And then you have people like Zillow, and you have Redfin, and then you have foreign investor funds that are in the millions and millions of dollars. As a real estate investor, I work with these funds. You have a $100 million fund coming from foreign countries coming into your market buying up homes. One of the issues that we have to address is that real estate brokers and the way we list properties, okay? There's no way that a first-time home buyer with an FH loan is going to win a bidding contract against a cash offer with zero contingencies. Okay? It's a real issue. Okay? So I understand the merits of this bill, you know, and I understand Representative Nash's position, you know, but, you know, I think that the conversation is important because I lived in that economy, in that environment for over 20 years. Okay. I live in California. I was a mortgage broker. I was a real estate investor. I went through that cycle. I saw families write up offers for homes for $100,000. And you know what the acceptance rate is? Zero. Zero. Why? Because it's all cash offer. Zero contingency. FHA loans, right? It's repeated business. Repeated business to real estate LLCs and investors who have hundreds of millions of dollars, who's going to come back and buy more homes and come back and it's a revolving door. So I understand the merits of this bill. I appreciate you bringing this conversation to this table and to this committee. And I'm happy to have more conversation around this topic. So thank you.
I'm going to go back to Representative Nash. I saw, then I'll go back to Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. The test fire, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but over there. You gave a quote that I thought was really resonating. You shared that folks should be able to pursue the fruit of their labor and sacrifice. I've had a really good career, and I have some liquid assets, and I would like to be able to invest perhaps in a corporate effort with my family and some friends because I would like to enjoy the fruit of my labor and sacrifice. I used to fly around the country, and I still do, but not as much. I used to fly about 175,000 air miles a year, flying all over the country, and I sacrificed my time, and I was able to earn money as a result of that. This bill would basically make it impossible for me to pursue a corporate entity I may choose to create, and the author did admit to that. That's crazy. That's craziness. Furthermore, Representative Chaud pointed out that the problem from his estimation is foreign investment groups and other things, but this is a very broad brush approach. This approach says, if there's six of you, no. Five, maybe we'll let that go. But what I'm hearing is the absolute excoriation of people who are, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. I did well. I didn't have $100 million, though. You're trying to solve something in a very granular, prohibitive bill that affects me and my family and perhaps some of my friends who may wish to pursue the American dream and buy property and develop it and own it and house people, be a good housing provider. Well, with this bill, I can't do that. And now my ability to use my capital that I worked my butt off to earn is basically being put on the chopping block. So I think that there are some problems. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I know that there are some enforcement pieces to this. I don't see a fiscal note. Is there a fiscal note that is coming along? What do we have going on?
Chair Howard, Representative Nash, a fiscal note has been requested. I would note for the committee, though, that there's two state entities named in the bill, the Minnesota Housing Finance for their exception piece, and the Attorney General, who's outside of this committee's budget jurisdiction.
And Mr. Chair, as a result of that, are you intending to lay this over, or are you going to be moving this out of committee?
We are moving this out of committee, Representative Nash.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, before we're wrapping up, I'm going to eventually make a motion to lay this on the table because we can't make a decision out of this if we don't have the fiscal notes. And you'll vote me down, I'm sure, but I'm still going to make the point that we can't continually get in the habit of passing bills out when we don't have solid fiscal information. This is the Committee of Jurisdiction for MHA, correct? So if we don't have the fiscal note, how do we responsibly move it out of committee unless it's just on a lick and a prayer that everything's going to be great or that we just don't care what the fiscal implications is because we're going to do it anyway?
I'll go to Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make comment that not all cash offers come only from corporate. Those of us that may have be able to get pre-approved loans and mortgages already can come into cash offers. And in our part of the state, it's not corporate that are overbidding and having houses sold at $100,000 above what the asking price was. It's greater Minnesota as well, and it's not by corporate. But I think the real question here is we are dealing with something that is certainly directly related to supply and demand. When you have 100,000, if you have 90,000 people that want homes and you only have 50,000 available, obviously you know that there's going to be a premium on those housing. So if you really want to deal with helping people get in houses, we need to figure out a way of keeping the supply up with the demand, which will automatically drive down the cost. And so that's one of the things that I think we need to be looking at that this bill certainly doesn't address, but it's worthy for discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. I will go to Representative Johnson, our lead.
Chair Howard, Representative Abadje, I have a few questions that I would hoping to get some answers for. First of all, I can't remember if it was asked before or not, but is this going to be retroactive? So the corporations that might own some single-family homes have to sell them or go through the enforcement process from the Attorney General's office?
Representative Egbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. As I stated earlier, this will be forward-looking.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Abadje, I'm thankful for that because one of the most valuable housing assets I have in my district is senior housing. We have an entire subdivision in two of my cities that are single family, duplex, threeplex and fourplex that are all senior, individual, independent living. It's owned by a corporation. They take care of their yards, any issues in the rental units, they take care of it. The way this bill was written, not another single one could be built. This is the concerns that we have. You might have an issue in your neighborhood. I looked at the map and yeah, there's some problems down in the metro area, inner core area. But guess what? What happened there is exactly what President Obama requested people to do in 2003. The Obama administration was incentivizing investors to purchase blighted homes, restore them, and rent them out. It worked. And now we're blaming, we have to blame the Obama administration for that because it actually worked. We have a big issue with very huge shortage of housing stock. This bill is going to make it worse. Because when investors come in, they might build 50 houses. And a lot of them are going to be spec homes. And with the current economy and the high interest rates, guess what? A lot of those homes that were already sold are going back because the individual, because of the high interest rates right now, cannot afford them. Now, if those builders and the investors that working on that subdivision, they can't let a house sit half built, they got to finish it. They might not have a buyer, but they need to get some of their investment back to cover their costs because they're still paying a lot of stuff. But this bill does not allow them to rent it out. And then I look at the enforcement part of this bill. The Attorney General can take somebody to court. The court says they have 1 year to sell all their assets. or the state will come in and sell them at public auction. I'm not even sure if that's constitutional. But what it does do is force somebody who's taking their hard-earned money and taking it away. They might have to sell it at a loss. And these investors might be somebody's pension fund. Yes, pension funds buy this stuff. They invest. Pension fund, if I remember correctly, owns the IDS. We got a lot of work to do on this bill. And as Representative Nash said, there's going to be costs. I believe there's going to be costs in the housing division. So the bill either have to come back here. But the way things have been moving so far, it'll probably be on the floor in a week and a half. But I guess I have one other question for you, Representative Badji. It's not against you personally. But one of the exemptions is nonprofit corporations. I guess I'd like to know why nonprofits are exempted when a relative of mine who sold their business had an LLC because of the dire and desperate need of tort reform to protect his personal assets, formed an LLC for the businesses he had, and invested in a number of homes that he had to put in the number, I think he's got five places that he bought for rentals, put between $40,000 and $60,000 worth of repairs to those houses so he could rent them out. But you're going to shut his income down. Shut him down completely. And he's doing a service to our communities because he's taken blighted houses, houses that nobody would buy because of the amount of work that they needed, and they just sit there empty. Instead, he's given an opportunity, especially in my area. We need workforce housing. That's workforce housing. Places to rent for families. So why would you exclude nonprofits?
Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I will go back and double check that. I don't believe we're excluding nonprofits, but I will go back to House Research and clarify, and when we update this, we'll make sure that that's clear.
Representative Johnson, if you...
It's on Representative Chair Howard, members, Representative Abadji. It's on line 1.20.
Representative and Representative Johnson, I'll go to Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 1.20 says corporate entity means any partnership, corporation, limited liability company, pension fund, or investment fund, or trust, but does not include a nonprofit corporation or family trust or family limited liability company. So if I understand your question correctly, it was why are we excluding nonprofits from this?
That is correct, Chair Howard.
Representative Igbaje.
So I believe that part of the reason why we might be excluding nonprofits is, we're looking at entities that are coming in, looking at housing more as a commodity on something in their portfolios, making large amounts of profits, and then using that to shut out regular people. What we've seen from nonprofits and nonprofit organizations is their motivations tend to be more to support people looking to get into home ownership. But if those are questions that you have, we can still continue to look into that and figure out where it's best to draw the line.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badge, I appreciate your remarks, but I don't think there's an investor at all anywhere, even in nonprofits, because they actually have to justify some of the funding that they spend, especially when it's state funding, because unfortunately, we as a state give billions of dollars to nonprofits all across the state in a variety of different things. But there isn't an investor, a builder that's not building these things to actually sell. Most of them want to sell them. The banks, a lot of builders don't have the capital to have all these homes sitting. They need them sold. I don't want them to be having a whole bunch of spec homes sitting empty, because we saw what happened to that when the housing crash. I had to deliver a lot of foreclosure papers during that time. But we need to give them latitude so they can build the housing stock we need. I think, if I remember correctly, there are like 5,000 homes on the market in the state. We need thousands more. But if the builders can't start building homes, and if they don't sell right away, have the ability to rent them out, especially right now with the high interest rates when people are canceling their contracts and we still need the housing stock, we're not going to have houses built. This bill needs to be a lot of work, and with that, Chair Howard, I'll make a motion that we lay this bill on the table.
So Representative Johnson has made a motion that we lay this bill on the table, and he'd like a roll call vote. So that motion is not debatable, so the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Howard.
Chair votes no.
Chair Howard, nay. Vice Chair Igbaje?
No.
Vice Chair Igbaje, nay. Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Jensen, aye. Representative Cha?
No.
Representative Cha, nay. Representative Dotseth?
Yes.
Representative Dotseth, aye. Representative Hassan?
No.
Representative Hassan, nay. Representative Hussein?
No.
Representative Hussein, nay. Representative Kozlowski?
No.
Representative Kozlowski, nay. Representative Myers?
Aye.
Representative Myers, aye. Representative Nash?
Aye.
Representative Nash, aye. Representative Norris?
No.
Representative Norris, nay. Representative Perez-Vega?
No.
Representative Perez-Vega, nay. Representative Petersburg?
Aye.
Representative Petersburg, aye. Chair, that concludes roll call with 5 ayes and 8 nays.
The motion does not prevail, so we're still on the motion to re-refer House File 685.
Mr. Chair, I request a roll call on the motion to move it to the next destination.
There will be a roll call vote on that. Sure, Representative Nash. Representative Perez-Vega, did you want to get on the list? No? Okay. Well, I'll just make a few comments before going to Representative Igbaje. I really do appreciate the conversation that the committee has had on this bill. I really think what underlies it and what we're after is something that I think this committee has shown a lot of agreement in, which is that we want to make sure that Minnesotans have the ability to get into home ownership and have a shot at the American dream. And I think for us to wrestle with is if we think when we have communities or neighborhoods in our state where 20, 30, 35, 40% of the homes are owned by corporate investors, is that a good thing for Minnesotans? I think the answer is no. What I do appreciate Representative Igbaje bringing this bill forward and for the discussion and the work that will continue on this bill. And I would hope that we could find a bipartisan path forward, again, underlying the fact that I think a lot of folks on this committee think we ought to create more opportunities for new homeowners here in Minnesota, and that's what I think this bill drives us towards. So with that, Representative Igbaje, any final words on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. I do appreciate the robust discussion. I've actually had many conversations with a couple of other groups as well. There will be a lot of work to be done on this bill, and I welcome that. I think that is part of what we're doing here in committee. It brings up issues where we need to make some changes, and it is my commitment that, you know, many of those changes that we've talked about will be made. As this moves forward, I hope that, you know, we'll find ways for more members to support it. But at the end of the day, the purpose of this is to try to get at a solution to ensure that more working class Minnesotans, families, can get into the home ownership market should they desire. And this is one of the barriers that's preventing that, and we want to try to remove it. So thank you.
Thank you. With that, I would renew my motion.
Mr. Chair, if you could tell us the pathway for this moving forward, where are we referring it to? And
judiciary. Representative Nash, this will bill be referred next to judiciary. And so with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 685 be referred to the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. And we'll ask the clerk to take the roll.
Chair Howard?
Aye.
Chair Howard, aye. Vice Chair Igbaje?
Aye.
Vice Chair Igbaje, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Shaw?
Aye.
Representative Shaw, aye. Representative Dotseth?
Nay.
Representative Dotseth, nay. Representative Hassan?
Aye.
Representative Hassan, aye. Representative Hussein? Representative Hussein, aye. Representative Kozlowski?
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski, aye. Representative Myers?
Nay.
Representative Myers, nay. Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Nash, nay. Representative Norris?
Aye.
Representative Norris, aye. Representative Perez Vega?
Aye.
Representative Perez Vega, aye. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Representative Petersburg, nay. Chair, that concludes roll call with 8 ayes and 5 nays.
The motion prevails, and House File 685 is re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Members, that concludes our bills today. We'll be back tomorrow where we'll have we're here for the commissioner and the presentation on the budget and House File 302. With that, we're adjourned.